In this record, I will talk first about some of the bewildering experiences that come with nervous illness, then about depression, and finally, about coming through setback. In my last talk, I spoke mostly about the physical symptoms of nervous illness, panic spasms, churning stomach, weakness, etc. There is much more to nervous illness than physical symptoms. Nervous illness may bring some very strange and bewildering experiences. It may bring feelings of indecision, suggestibility, loss of confidence, agitation, feelings of personality disintegration, of unreality. It may also bring obsession, apathy, depression. If these experiences do come, one usually develops from the other in an understandable way. There is no mystery here. This is not the maze a nervously ill person imagines it to be. Indeed, it is enlightening to see the pattern behind so much nervous illness. Even the nervously ill person's thoughts may follow a set pattern, an expected pattern. Indeed, I often know what he's about to say as soon as he begins to speak. So often have I heard his story before. For example, the fear that the nervously ill mother will harm her child is so common, one comes to expect it as part of the illness of any mother. And yet this poor woman usually thinks that she must be some sort of special monster to feel this way. The truth is that thoughts like hers are normal in the circumstances. Now, these experiences, indecision, suggestibility, loss of confidence, feelings of personality disintegration, feelings of unreality, obsession, depression, these develop very much in the order in which I've just stated them. That is the pattern. First comes indecision, and it arises so simply, so easily. It comes because with sensitization, intense feeling follows the slightest anxious thought so swiftly, the sensitized person seems to be at the mercy of his feelings, as if they are beyond his control. He has but to think on one aspect of a problem to feel immediately a strong emotional reaction to it, and then he has only to think about a different aspect of the same problem to feel just as strongly about it. These swiftly changing reactions interfere with calm, clear thinking, and so making decision may seem almost impossible. The nervously ill person thinks one way one minute, another the next. Each point of view seems equally important, equally right, and yet a moment later, equally wrong. Even the simple decision to take an umbrella or not may seem beyond him. When one man complained of being unable to make decisions, he was told that he had but to make a supreme effort and decide once, and his battle would be won. From then on, said his adviser, he would have no more trouble making decisions. Now, this advice was misleading. This person may make a great effort and make an important decision, but this will not alter the fact that he's still sensitized and therefore likely to react too emotionally when under stress for some time to come, so that in the immediate future, making a decision could be just as difficult as ever. Understanding why it is so difficult to make up his mind helps a nervously ill person much more than trying to persevere and make decisions. It also helps to know that when he's well and emotions calm down, he will be as capable as ever of making up his own mind, perhaps more capable because of the unique experience he is having now in learning how to cope with himself while under great stress. It is not necessary to force himself to make decisions while ill. It is important only to understand why it is difficult to do so. To understand that it is difficult because intense feeling follows anxious thought so swiftly. And because a nervously ill person finds difficulty in making up his own mind, he is vulnerable to the suggestions of others. He may be pitifully suggestible. He is especially vulnerable to his own destructive suggestions, particularly to the self-suggestion that he will never recover. His reaction to this may be terrific. Because of indecision and suggestibility, loss of confidence must surely follow. How could it not? Can you see how the pattern unfolds? Such a logical pattern, when we understand how exaggerated emotions can delude us. And because his emotional reactions are so unpredictable, are so exaggerated, so frightening, and come so quickly, the nervously ill person feels no inner strength on which to depend, no inner self from which to seek direction. It is this lack of inner harmony, holding thought, feeling, and action together, which leads him to choose the word disintegration to describe the way he feels. Old-fashioned sayings can be surprisingly apt when applied to nervous illness. The saying, pull yourself together, this describes so well what a nervously ill person thinks he should do, but feels he cannot do. It is as if he must gather the disintegrated pieces of his personality together and fit them into place, as one would gather the scattered pieces of a jigsaw puzzle and fit them into place, before the picture of an integrated person can emerge, before he can be himself again. Also, the sufferer thinks he's failed himself and his family by breaking down, and he is only too ready to give himself the full defeatist treatment at the slightest encouragement. And because this is all such a strain to bear, an otherwise good-natured person may find himself becoming bad-tempered with those he loves most, especially with those he loves most, because if they, of all people, cannot understand when he turns to them for help, he feels desperate, as if he's grasping a candy floss for support. And the tension caused by continuous strain gradually becomes agitation, so that any frustration, such as simply waiting in a queue, may seem intolerable. Now this is all so puzzling. The sufferer will look at others in the street and think, why can't I be like them? What is this strange thing that is happening to me? He becomes more and more bewildered because he used not be like this. So he becomes more and more preoccupied with himself, with his thoughts, his feelings, trying to puzzle a way out of his maze while he waits apprehensively for what might happen next. Gradually, he pays less and less attention to outside events, more and more attention to what is taking place within him. This narrowing of interest to himself leads to a feeling of withdrawal from the outside world, as if people around him live in one world, the world he used to live in, and he in a strange, unreal world. He may have this feeling of unreality in flashes, or he may have it constantly, and he struggles desperately to get back into that other real world, the world he used to know. He mistakes this feeling of unreality for mental illness, and this makes him even more afraid and tense, even more alerted to notice every unreal moment and dread it increasingly. This feeling of unreality is one of the most perplexing experiences in nervous illness, and about which some people complain most bitterly. It is not the madness the sick person thinks it is. It is mental fatigue from living too much in an inner world of anxiety, from too much preoccupation with self, so that when the sufferer looks at those around him, he feels as if there is a curtain between them and him, a curtain he can neither lift nor break through. A nervously ill person may feel unreal in many different ways. He may say, I feel as if I'm outside myself, watching myself. Or he may say, when I touch things, I can see I'm touching them, but I can't feel I'm doing it. Or he may complain of being unable to feel any love for those he used to love dearly. A mother will often say she can feel no love for her own children, that it is as if she has a vacuum where normal feelings should be. Such a person has merely exhausted her capacity to feel normal emotion because she has felt fearful emotions too intensely for so long. One young man described his feeling of unreality very clearly. He said that on one occasion when going for a swim, he had to pass through a dark passageway before emerging into the full sunshine of the beach. This sudden contrast was so arresting, It made him acutely aware of a strange feeling of isolation, almost of darkness, within himself. The crowds of coloured umbrellas and laughing people, although so close, seemed miles away, as if on a stage, and he merely looking on. The harder he tried to become part of that scene, the further it seemed to recede, the more unreal it became. He was shocked by the mental state he thought he must be in. Actually, brain fag from so much anxious thinking had gradually so dulled his world, it was as if he'd lived for months in the semi-darkness of that tunnel without realizing it. Small wonder that the sudden contrast of brilliant sunshine on white sand and gay colors came as a shock. This was a natural happening, not the threat of madness he mistook it for. Had he not become alarmed by it, and so made himself more aware of it, his feeling of unreality would have soon passed. When the cause of feeling unreal is explained to a nervously ill person as no more than a natural result of too much anxious brooding, too much preoccupation with self, he may be so relieved he may lose all fear of it. And this sudden release from fear may make him feel more real, more part of the outside world than he has ever felt before. But this newly gained feeling of reality may not last long. The experience of feeling unreal is still so recent. It is only natural that it will return again. Memory alone will bring it back. And when it does return, so many people make the mistake of once more becoming upset by it and thinking that its cause must be, for them, very deep-seated indeed. A nervously ill person is so easily bluffed by his feelings of the moment because they are so hard to bear and therefore seem so important. Very strange feelings indeed may momentarily, from time to time, sweep over the nervously ill, and recovery lies in passing right through these moments again and again, until they no longer matter. Strange feelings in nervous illness have no real significance. Recovery does not lie in trying to switch them off, in trying to tranquilize them away, or in trying to avoid them, withdraw from them. Recovery lies in going right through them with utter acceptance in as relaxed a way as possible. When I say this to some people, they immediately answer, "Now that's just my trouble, doctor. I can't relax, so I couldn't possibly do what you ask." My answer is, if you cannot relax your body at this stage, and I do understand this, you can at least relax your attitude to your illness. You can at least try not to worry because you feel this way. It is the worry that tenses. Acceptance and understanding begin the process of bodily relaxation. So, if a feeling of unreality is part of your illness, be prepared to work with it, live with it, without being so impressed by it. This feeling can be very upsetting, but it is not in the least important. Can you see how the pattern unfolds? Indecision, suggestibility, loss of confidence, agitation, feelings of personality disintegration, feelings of unreality, such an understandable procession, with one experience leading to the other, and each depending on sensitized reaction to thoughts that are natural in the circumstances. As I said earlier, this is not the maze the nervously ill person imagines it to be, and it is not unique to him. Many have had these experiences before him. And what of obsession? Obsession experienced in nervous illness may be very disturbing. It may be repeated compulsive thought or action, and it develops from no more than brain fag in a sensitized body. After a student has worked for 3 or 4 hours, he may feel suddenly mentally tired, as if he cannot pack in another word, so he may rest until his mind is refreshed. A nervously ill person is a particular kind of student. He has been studying himself constantly for weeks, months, even years, and he rarely pauses to rest his mind. So he may be suffering from chronic brain fag without knowing it. When a mind becomes very tired, it seems to lose its resilience, so that any anxious thought seems to cling, to come again and again. And because sensitization brings exaggerated emotional reaction, anxious thoughts may make a very deep impression indeed and cling all the more stubbornly, perhaps to become established as a recurring, frightening habit. Obsession is so often no more than this, no more than the inflexible working of a very tired mind in a sensitized, frightened person. The nervously ill mother I mentioned earlier, who is afraid of harming her child, may be holding her baby when she may think, "Wouldn't it be terrible if I were to harm my child while I'm like this?" She may panic at the thought. And because she's sensitized, her feeling of panic may be almost overwhelming, so that the thought makes a deep impression. Indeed, she may feel swept away by it to a point where she seems to be all feeling, incapable of thinking. She becomes terrified of this experience and lives in dread of it returning. Naturally, arousing so much interest, so much fear, it returns. And each time it comes, she invariably repeats the original mistake of withdrawing from the thought in terror. She herself establishes the experience as a recurring habit of thought, as a dreaded obsession. A person with a compulsion to wash his hands could wash his hands for hours without much fatigue, if he did so willingly. It is the despair, the exasperation, the tension, the fear that accompany the obsession, whatever the obsession may be, that tire to a point where reasoning becomes difficult and thought becomes compulsion. The best way to cope with obsession is to take the fear and tension out of it, so that only thought remains and no one need be bluffed by a thought. To take the fear and tension out of obsession, the nervously ill person must be prepared to accept his obsession and live with it for the time being. He must understand that he cannot be rid of it overnight. Just as a runner in a race, having touched the goal, must run on until the force he has gathered spends itself, so a person with an obsession must go on with the obsession until the forces behind it spend themselves. And these forces are tension and fear working in a very tired mind. Remove fear with understanding and acceptance, then tension gradually lifts and the mind can refresh itself. To a refreshed mind freed from fear, obsession loses its driving power and the sufferer is left with only a memory of past suffering. This takes time and a lot of acceptance. And it takes much failure, much despair. But with continued acceptance, despite defeat, despite despair, ultimate success is assured. To help my patients with obsession, I make tape recordings of their interviews with me, and they then use these whenever they need reassurance and guidance, which is often, much oftener than the weekly or fortnightly visit usually allowed. Indeed, help may be needed hourly in the beginning, or even oftener than this. To cure obsession, then, one should accept it, not fight it. But while accepting it, try to be unafraid of it. Try to see it for what it is, no more than the working of a very tired mind in a tense body that has been sensitized by fear, especially fear of the obsession. I describe the different kinds of obsession and give more details of their cure in the new 1966 edition of my book. Now, the feelings I have been describing are very expensive in terms of nervous energy. Our body can be likened to a car battery. If we keep thrashing the self-starter, the battery eventually goes flat. And this is what happens to the emotional reserves of a nervously ill person. If he keeps thrashing himself with panic and despair, his emotional battery becomes exhausted and he feels apathetic, depressed. So there they are, some of the most bewildering experiences that nervous illness can bring. And yet, can you see how simply they can arise and how easily one may lead to the other? No mystery here, no need for bewilderment. The nervously ill person should accept every strange aspect of his illness, accept his strange thoughts, however strange, and realize that they are only thoughts and that he need not be bluffed by thought. Acceptance gives his body a chance to calm itself, if only a little at first, at least enough to begin desensitization, enough to begin the process of recovery. As sensitization lessens, emotional reaction becomes less acute, and so it loses its power to disturb, to distract. And then thinking becomes easier. Decisions can be made, and confidence regained. The person recovering this way is no longer so suggestible to the opinions of others. And as he regains confidence, as he sees how acceptance works, he's no longer so vulnerable to his own destructive suggestion that he will never recover. Indeed, he glimpses at last the way out of his darkness. He no longer feels so much like a rudderless boat adrift on a turbulent sea. As bewilderment lessens and he finds less and less to be anxious about, introspection lessens and interest in the outside world returns so that the feeling of unreality gradually disappears. And as interest returns, depression lifts. He is beginning to be his old self once more. Just as each step led into nervous illness, now each step leads out of nervous illness. With the healing that understanding and acceptance bring, the pattern unfolds once more, step by step, but this time toward recovery. The talk to follow will be about depression. So far, I have been mostly concerned in these talks with people made ill by fear of the state they are in, by fear of what their nerves are doing to them, rather than by fear of any particular problem. Of course, there are many people who have been made nervously ill and kept ill by some apparently insoluble problem, by some conflict, sorrow, guilt, or disgrace. And I discuss these people in detail in my book. Unfortunately, there is no time for such discussion here. However, the advice given in these talks on how to cope with the physical symptoms and the strange experiences of nervous illness will help people cope with themselves while they try to cope with their particular problem. For more detailed help, I do refer them to my book. Now, I have stressed again and again the folly of fighting one's nervous symptoms. I have shown how much nervous illness may be started and kept alive by fighting. I stress this because there is such widespread misconception today that one should fight one's nerves. Friends, even some doctors, don't hesitate to say, "You'll have to fight this thing, old man. You mustn't let this get the better of you." And this advice is often given in a tone of voice of doom to follow if it is not obeyed. But fighting the way a nervously ill person invariably fights means more and more tension, therefore more and more suffering, and so more bewilderment, more fear. Bewilderment and fear can themselves create nervous illness, so the advice to fight one's nerves can be more damaging than helpful. You might well ask, but what of depression? Surely this is the one illness we should fight. We can't let depression get a hold on us. We must fight depression. My answer is still the same. There is a far better way of coping with depression than by fighting it. I don't mean that you should sit and gaze apathetically at the ceiling. I mean something very different from apathetic ceiling gazing, as I will now show you. People with a habit of recurring depression respond so quickly and so acutely to even a mildly depressing atmosphere that they have but to see lowering clouds at dusk or hear rooks in the belfry to literally feel their spirits sink. Usually, their attention is soon distracted and they quickly recover. However, they need have only a few such experiences in close succession to be convinced that a bout of depression is on its way. Then they immediately become apprehensive, afraid. Who wouldn't? There's nothing quite as depressing as depression. And because depressed reaction usually comes when such people are overtired, the added strain of apprehension and fear of depression drains their emotions still further and so makes depression more likely to descend. Let us look closely at such a person and see the mistakes made, mistakes that not only invite depression, but prolong its visit. You will see that these mistakes arise very much from trying to fight first the thought of approaching depression, and then from trying to fight depression itself. Let us look at a housewife who suffers from depression. I choose a woman rather than a man, because a woman's life at home is more conducive to depression than a man's life in the outside world. I also choose a woman who is subject to frequent bouts of rather severe depression, so that the lurking shadow of depression may never be far away. Of course, what I say applies to men as well as women. Many men become depressed, especially men whose work demands much emotional energy. First, this housewife, whom we are about to consider, dreads and fears depression, so that when she feels one of her bouts approaching, she may rush feverishly through her work, trying to fill each moment, so that she will have no time to think about that hovering cloud. The fight has begun. And when her work is finished, she is so afraid to be alone, occupied with her thoughts, her feelings, she's off visiting one friend after another. She's off to the cinema, away to the supermarket, rushing here, rushing there, trying to forget the state she is in, trying to push away the threat of depression. But all the time, even when out, she watches herself apprehensively, thinking, oh my goodness, is it still there? I hope it won't come back when I get home. It is difficult to forget something while trying so hard to forget. The best way to remember is to try too hard to forget. So by feverishly rushing around, trying to ward off depression, trying so hard to forget that it threatens, this woman may succeed only in emphasizing the threat. Also, agitated rushing is very tiring, so she becomes overtired, tense and irritable. Putting on an act before the family is also a strain, so the tension mounts and gradually brings sensitization. And the wave of fear she feels then, when she thinks of approaching depression, becomes more and more acute. This spasm of fear comes in the pit of her stomach, in the exact spot where she feels the sinking feeling of depression. Indeed, there's so little to choose between these two feelings, fear and depression, that as the fear mounts, she translates this feeling of fear into the feeling of depression itself and is finally convinced that depression has arrived. At this point, she despairs, and despair is the finishing touch. She has but to feel one flash of utter despair to at last admit to herself and to the family that she really is having one of her bouts. And now comes the barrage of advice from family and friends. Pull yourself together, mother. Snap out of it, mother. Fight it, mother. As if she hasn't already been fighting it for days, weeks, and getting nowhere, except more deeply enmeshed. However, she starts once more on the old routine, rushing here, rushing there, fighting this, fighting that, trying to snap out of it, trying to rise above it. She takes antidepressant pills each morning to help pick herself up, sedatives each afternoon to help calm herself down, a pill for this and a pill for that. While out visiting, she may sometimes feel almost happy and for a moment may forget her depression. But when she thinks of it again, the contrast between the cheerfulness she's been feeling while happily distracted and the sinking feeling that comes as she remembers the state she is in strikes like a blow, and her spirits sink immediately, even deeper than before. The fight seems hopeless. What is the use of forgetting when remembering is such pain? so she may return home more depressed, more discouraged than when she set out. Sometimes she may start for home feeling good, only to find that the very sight of the house throws her into deep despair once more. While she is so easily cast down, it is difficult to remember that in the past depression always lifted. With each new bout, there is always the fear that this one will stay. But depression always eventually passes, because it is a state of emotional depletion. And as one's emotional reserves rebuild, spirits automatically rise. And emotional reserves do replenish themselves, even during depression. So one morning, despite herself, this woman will waken to find less foreboding, more interest. From past experience, she knows this sign well. It means that this bout of depression is on its way out at last. She immediately takes heart, fears it less, becomes less tense, is even prepared to wait patiently for it to go completely. Now, this is a story of complete mismanagement. Mismanagement that not only establishes recurring bouts of depression as a habit, but also prolongs each bout. Just what should a person do to prevent depression descending, or if it has already descended, to help lift themselves out of it? Change, interesting occupation, company are well-known aids in abolishing depression. They divert attention from those expensive emotions, fear and despair, and so give opportunity for natural healing. But change, interesting occupation and company are not always available. Most people must recover in their usual routine, especially a housewife. So what can they do to help themselves? Indeed, if you suffer from depression, what can you do to help yourself? When you first feel that sinking feeling of depression, you should have the courage to let the feeling come. Relax toward it. Don't tense yourself against it in fear, in dread. If you feel apathetic, depressed, try to understand that this is a reaction that has been fostered by habit and memory and encouraged by emotional and even mental tiredness. Don't run tensely, blindly from the thought of depression, with your mind closed against it in fear. Don't drain your emotional reserves still further by indulging in those devitalizing emotions, fear and despair, especially despair. Work at a steady pace, your usual pace, so that you can take time to think calmly of yourself, think calmly of your work, and especially take time to think calmly about depression. I don't mean that you should sit and wallow in depression. By all means, take every opportunity that offers to help cheer yourself, help recharge your emotional batteries. But do this at a normal pace, at a steady pace. If, while out, you forget your depression for a while, don't be too cast down when you remember it again. If you accept that your batteries are flat for the moment and that emotions will swing up one minute and down the next, your acceptance will cushion the shock of remembering depression, and this will protect your emotions from your own onslaught upon them, and give your body a chance to heal itself, to replenish its stores. Your body will heal depression just as it will heal a broken leg if you give it a chance. Waking depressed in the morning deserves special mention. It is strange how the morning has a disconcerting habit of paying little regard to any improvement of the day before. People are disappointed if, when after retiring to bed feeling cheerful, they wake the next morning to find the same old heart of lead, the same strange feeling of foreboding, the same desire to pull the blankets over their head and not face the day. It is as if the morning takes a special delight in lagging behind the pace of their recovery. When a nervously ill person wakes in the morning feeling happy, he is well on the way to recovery. To cope with that dreaded early morning feeling, one should rise on waking, have a shower, cup of coffee or tea, even switch on the radio. Now, this is not fighting depression. This is sensible, because in the early morning, our metabolic rate, that is the rate at which our cells produce energy, is at its lowest, so that depression may then feel most acute. Rising on waking quickens metabolic rate, literally pulls one's body together, so that even if one has to return to bed until the family rises, one can rest a little more easily in bed. So rise on waking. I don't mean at 4 o'clock, while the moon is still shining and the owl still sitting on the fence. Moderation in all things. I discuss early morning depression more fully in my book. It takes courage to relax toward depression. One might even say to rest in depression and not try to fight it by seeking salvation in hectic, tiring distractions. To face, accept, and keep quietly working at a normal pace. That is the secret, at a normal pace. This will work a miracle if done without fear. And now I will speak about coming through setback. By now, some of you who've been listening to these records will have been practicing what I have been advising and may have many questions to ask. I will now answer your questions. Your immediate reaction could be, how can this doctor answer questions she's not yet heard? Believe me, I've heard your questions. During the last 40 years, I've heard them again and again. When I say that this talk is about setbacks on the road to recovery, isn't that already beginning to answer your questions? When I speak of setbacks, I do not mean that all nervously ill people must have setbacks before they can recover. Some people, on hearing a satisfactory explanation of their illness, lose all fear of it and recover remarkably quickly. Others find recovery difficult and long. These are the people with questions to ask, and theirs are the questions I will now answer. Most nervously ill people are surprised to hear that they can make as much progress toward recovery in a setback as in a good spell. In a good period, they certainly gather hope, feel the healing effect of peace, may even become exhilarated and think they've found the magic wand at last, and so they have. But usually, at the back of their mind, always lurks the thought, what if it were to come back again? And of course, sensitization, not yet completely healed, together with memory, will certainly do their best to see that it returns from time to time. Memory is ready to waylay at every turn in the road. The sufferer has seen that street, those houses, those shops so often, the very sight of them wearies and spells illness. And when memory strikes, because sensitization brings such exaggerated feelings, each frightening experience, each frightening sensation that memory recalls may bring such intense suffering, its victim can so easily be duped into mistaking memory for reality. So easily duped into thinking that he has slipped right back to the very bottom of the ladder once more. The contrast between the hope and peace just experienced in a good spell and the renewed suffering felt in setback highlights the suffering and makes it seem more unendurable than ever. It is this contrast that may make the early setback seem so especially severe and bring such disappointment, such despair, that the sufferer may decide that the struggle to climb up the ladder to recovery again is beyond him. It seems as if something is always ready to drag him back whenever he tries to go forward. It is hard for him to understand how it is possible to feel so desperate so suddenly when but a few hours earlier he was feeling well, even optimistic. He had thought that as he recovered, setbacks, if they occurred, would be less and less severe, occur less and less often, and so they might. But as I have explained, they can just as well seem worse than ever. Indeed, the worst setback of all may come just before complete recovery, simply because recovery is so close. The closeness of recovery makes a setback at that time especially frustrating. And yet, however severe setback may be, and however close to recovery it may come, it makes no difference to ultimate recovery if it is coped with the right way. This is why, when trying to recover, you should understand the tricks memory can play and understand setbacks so well you are not discouraged by it, however long it may last or whenever it may come. You must learn to appreciate the difference between memory and reality, and understand that when memory slips right back, you don't have to slip back with it. Let memory slip back. Let it slip back as far as it wants to, and don't withdraw from it in fear. Accept all the memories of past suffering. Accept all the present feelings of apprehension these memories may bring, and at the same time realize that they are only memories, only thoughts, and that you need not be bluffed by thoughts, need not be dragged back by thoughts, however painful they may seem. You need not be bluffed by thought any more than you need be bluffed by physical feeling, however horrible it may seem. As acceptance heals sensitization, feeling will not follow thought so swiftly, so intensely, and you will be at last able to reason less emotionally with memory, able to reason with your feelings, even able to reason with fear. Confidence comes only from experience, and some of the best experiences lie in coming through setback. Because, as I said earlier, each setback gives yet another chance to practice again what I have been teaching until you make this teaching part of yourself. Make it so inbuilt that your reactions in any future disturbing situation will not be the old frightening flashback reactions, but will gradually be the right ones, will be reactions without so much fear. You will know the way out of setbacks so well, you will no longer fear the way in. But this takes time. Therefore, you must not begrudge and count each day, each week spent in a setback. You must not think, oh my goodness, this one's lasted a fortnight. This is worse than the last. I must be getting worse. I'll never get out of this one. If a particular setback is distressingly long, I am sure you will find that it is because you're waiting too anxiously for it to go, that you're withdrawing from it in fear, or that you are impatiently trying to break your way through it, trying to fight it, or that you have become hopeless about ever recovering. You must give as much time to coming through each setback as it demands. I am often asked why a nervously ill person during recovery can feel so well one day and then for no apparent reason feel so ill the next. For example, why he can travel into town without fear one day and yet the next day, for no reason he can discover, feel the old fear so acutely it is as if the good journey had never been made. Strangely enough, and I mentioned this in my last record, it is because yesterday's journey was so successful that he is vulnerable to defeat today. The memory of yesterday's success may make him just a little too anxious to do as well again today, so he may start that journey into town a little apprehensively, therefore slightly more sensitized than he was yesterday, so that it may take only some minor incident on the way into town to make him flash panic immediately. As soon as he panics, he is convinced that this journey will be a failure. So he despairs. And such acute emotion as despair sensitizes him once more and makes him more apprehensive, more vulnerable to his destructive suggestion of failure. He is making the mistake of testing himself. You must practice, not test. Don't set an examination for yourself to see if you can travel without panic. If you have panic after panic, but try to take the panic the right way, the journey made with panic is just as successful as a journey made without panic. Also, when you test yourself, failure brings a sense of defeat, Whereas if you practice, failure simply means that you can practice once again. Can you see the difference between testing and practicing? The very thought of testing brings tension, whereas the thought of practicing holds no urgent demand and therefore brings much less tension. Also, the early stages of recovery may seem unreal. Doing the unusual, although it may be no more than boarding a bus alone, may seem very unreal. So that in the beginning, even when successful, there may be no satisfactory feeling of achievement, only a feeling of strangeness. Indeed, one's illness may seem safer, more real, than the early stages of recovery. So that the journey into town may have to be made successfully many times before it is accompanied by any real sense of achievement. Achievement must be consolidated before you can feel you have firm ground beneath your feet from which to face the future. At this stage, you may even shrink from the thought of full recovery in the future and the demands that this may bring. You imagine yourself trying to meet these demands as you feel now, still ill. But recovery brings its own changes. It brings renewed strength, renewed interest, and with these comes ability to cope. You must go forward with trust in this change, trust in a gradual merging into normal living once more. It is the gradualness that makes all possible. But it is also this very gradualness that is so hard for the nervously ill person to appreciate because it is so frustrating. Also, gradualness allows time for so much contemplation, and contemplation is the killer. Only memory of sufficient achievement can take the fear out of contemplation. This is why time must be allowed to pass. Imagination has flashed so many pictures of the difficulties on the way to recovery over such a long time that these difficulties have come to seem so concrete they cannot be thought away, cannot be talked away, only repeated. Successful achievement can finally take the fear out of contemplation. So don't be disheartened if at this stage you simply cannot see yourself ever going here, going there, doing this, doing that. The very thought of it may strike like a blow, and yet salvation lies in repeated doing. It lies in doing until the habit of doing is so well established it replaces the long habit of defeatist thinking. This takes time and effort, because the habit of defeatist thinking is so strong that although you may have made many successful journeys by now, deciding to go out and then starting off may seem almost as difficult today as it did in the beginning. Don't be discouraged by this. Let more time pass until the memory of more and more successful achievement accumulates to finally bring you the confidence, the certainty you crave. When I review the difficulties of recovery, I would say that the most alarming of them all is the way panic can flash so intensely, so quickly, and so unexpectedly, weeks, months, even years after a person may think he has completely recovered. In my experience, this unexpected reappearance of panic causes more concern than any other aspect of nervous illness. It shocks, it frightens, and it reminds. That is why it is so shocking. It reminds one of so much one would rather forget forever. And the fear that is immediately added, together with the actual physical disturbance caused by the flash of panic, resensitizes slightly and brings back some of the old, almost forgotten sensations of nervous illness, so that the unwary sufferer is often bluffed into thinking it has returned, or that it will return if he doesn't watch out. Almost invariably, he makes the old mistake of capitulating before the feeling and of trying to run away from it. One woman, who had a return of panic while shopping, immediately dashed back to the safety of home and then avoided that particular shop for weeks. She retreated in fear from fear once more. She avoided once more. Never do this. Never let an unexpected return of panic, whenever it may strike, even if it comes years after you think you have recovered, never let it shock you into running away from it. Halt! Go slowly. See the panic through. And then quietly go on with what you are doing. Let the panic come again and again if it wants to. Don't try to switch it off. Don't withdraw blindly from it. Understand that some tension, some strain may have slightly sensitized you once more, or that memory stirred by some sight, even some smell, may have fleshed the old feeling again. Any one of us at times may become slightly sensitized by strain, so that we feel on edge, apprehensive. If this happens to a person who has felt panic intensely in the past, his feeling of apprehension can so quickly flash to a feeling of panic, because the way to panic in him is so well worn. One could almost say that his panic mechanism is well oiled. If you can accept that for a long time to come, and by this I mean even years, if you can accept that you can give yourself a strong flash of panic from time to time, and if you can realize that this means no more than that you are slightly sensitized for the moment, or that memory has stirred the embers of your illness, if you can see this panic for what it is, no more than a physical feeling without real significance, and if you can accept it without withdrawing from it in fear, then you are truly recovered despite occasional bouts of recurring panic. Recovery from panic always lies on the other side of panic, whenever it may come. Always see it quietly through. Never run home in fear. Never begin avoiding once more. So accept everything about your illness. Don't waste energy trying to work it all out. Don't be dismayed by setback. Don't be bluffed by memory. Don't be perplexed because you're well one day and ill the next. Don't be dismayed when achievement seems unreal. Don't be overawed by defeatist contemplation. Don't be afraid that you lose what you gained yesterday if you don't practice today. And practice, never test. Don't be dismayed if you feel nervier than ever when you start the journey to recovery. Don't be too discouraged by physical illness. And above all, don't be bluffed by returns of panic. I know you think that there is so much to do, so much to remember in these two records. There isn't, you know. It's all in one word, accept. It won't matter if you forget the rest, as long as you remember that one little word, accept. I make it sound so easy, don't I? It's not easy. But if you're determined to practice utter, utter acceptance, it's not so difficult either. Once more, good luck.
This has been a Highbridge Audio presentation.